Welcome to Girls Room, where each week we unpack the foundational text of the 2010s, HBO's Girls. I'm Julia Gray, and with me I have my incredible co-host, Drew Haskins.
Howdy.
And we have a very special guest, Brenda Jugata. How you doing?
Hi, good. How are you?
I didn't ask ahead. What? I didn't credit you. How are we crediting you these days?
Freelance writer and union organizer.
I love that.
Love it.
And culture aficionado, brilliant writer.
Thank you. Thank you. what does Hannah say? The voice of a generation? Or a voice
Exactly.
of a
A
generation?
voice of a generation. Wow. That one really stuck with me. That's one of the girls' quotes that will never leave my brain. I'll be saying it on my deathbed.
Literally, I mean, it got
Yeah.
people so mad. I feel like it was, yeah, peak misunderstanding the whole Hannah's whole bit, you know, with people getting into that
Absolutely.
line. Yeah.
Before we jump into any episode talk, I want to hear about your experience with the show Girls. Like, I didn't know you were a girls girl. I want to hear about, like, when did you become a fan, etc.
A girl's girl, yes. When did I become a fan? I became a fan randomly. I watched the randomest things, like on the plane to India, because it's such a long flight, and I like just run out of things. So I just, you know, I hadn't really given Girls that much of a chance, and then I was going to India. It was towards the end of Girls's run. I think it was probably like 2015 or 2016. And I was like going to India, and I like just randomly, they had like two random episodes from vastly different seasons. And I just like watched them. And I was like, oh my God, I am obsessed with this. I have to watch the whole thing. And then I watched all of it in like, you know, like 5 days or something.
What year was this?
This must have been, so wait, what year did Girls end? This is like the year before.
This is 2017.
2017. So I think this was either, this is end of 2015 or... Yeah, I think it was end of 2015 that this happened.
Yeah.
That I had this like revelation that I love the show. And then I watched the last two seasons like in real time.
I love that. That's a great girl's origin story.
Thank you. Thank you. And now I am working on my own screenplay for fun. And I have been kind of like scared to delve into Girls again because I just like, I'm so jealous. I have so much like... writer envy, where I'm like, oh, like I just can't, like I'm gonna compare to what I've written and like,
I
but
feel
yeah,
every millennial girl writer has the Lena Dunham fear, you know,
exactly,
or Lena Dunham envy.
Have you ever rewatched the show, or have you just done like that initial watch?
I did that initial, I'm trying to think if I ever, I think I did do a rewatch at some point, and then obviously ahead of this, you know, to us taping this, I rewatched like a bunch of episodes. So, and I'm about to start from season one because I'm hooked again.
Get that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's time. I did this thing that on TikTok, they said, I like refer to everyone as just like one unified source, like TikTok told me, but yeah, TikTok was telling me to buy the script of Fleabag and like read along, because apparently you glean a lot from doing that, and I kind of want to do that with Girls. I want to like see if I can buy the script somewhere.
Oh,
I love that. Wait, it's, I actually, for this exact episode, you can just like Google an episode and write like Girls season 6 episode 3 script. And they're all there. You can find them.
Okay, I can just Google it. That sounds like a good plan. Did you
it's
see
this
that tweet?
Amazing thing called Google.
I know.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
Like, I've never thought of this. did you see that tweet that was like, why am I on a date and this guy like pulled up the whatever some episode of Girls and is making me read it out loud?
Oh my God! No.
No.
Did it specify which episode, which scene? I need to meet this man.
It did. I'll find the tweet and I'll send it to you. I literally was like, I sent this to like so many friends and I was like, this is my dream date. Like, I want to be doing this.
Oh, yeah.
I want to do a table read. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So funny.
So funny. I need to update all my dating app bios like pronto to get somehow like manifest this for me. Like, this is what I've always wanted.
You're, You're a voice of a generation. I think that's a good bio, a good lead.
That is a great bio, actually.
So, Rinda, we ask every guest, which girl are you at your core, at your essence?
Oh, God. Okay. I feel like, is it like a faux pas? Like, okay, like, you know how if you ask someone what, like, Harry Potter house they are, if they say they're, like, a Gryffindor, it's kind of like a faux pas to be like, I am brave. Like, I am whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm like, is it a faux pas to say you're the main character? Like, can I just, like.
Not at all.
No.
She's one of five. Is it four or five? She's one of the few choices.
Right. So I guess it's okay. I feel like I'm Hannah. I am kind of a narcissist and kind of, I love to talk. And yeah, I feel like, I mean, they're all kind of narcissists, I guess, is the thing. But like, I feel like all of Hannah's insecurities are my insecurities. And like, all of the things she thinks are so great about herself are also, unfortunately, the things I think are so great about myself. So yeah, I definitely am Hannah.
I feel that I'm similar. I'm like a Hannah Shosh cusp. I feel like you could be a Hannah Shosh cusp as well.
Okay, yeah, Shosh. I mean, it's good to have a little Shosh in you because that's like the grounding element. Like, you're not, mm-hmm. yeah, you have some tie to reality. Also, like, extremely anxious, which I also resonates. I'm not gonna lie, I want to be fucking Jessa. Like, I really do. I guess everyone does. That's the whole thing.
Very few people have come on this podcast and declared Jessa. Yeah.
What do you want to say?
That's a good question. What would you say, Drew?
I can say every single, with confidence, every single writer who has ever come on the show has said Hannah.
That's not
at
true.
Least in part. Almost everyone. I like, if we model, if we do the data visualizations, I do think that, like,
maybe almost a lot of people say Marnie. We get a lot of Marnie.
We do get a lot of Marnies.
Really? I was gonna say, like, has anyone ever said Marnie? I can't imagine.
Oh yeah.
Me. Wait, you're a Marnie.
Oh yeah. I mean, me pulling out like data visualization and stats, like, yes, I'm the Marnie. I find her really reminiscent of like the worst parts of myself, which is hard to, I think that is like just the girls of it all in general. Like, these are not characters who reveal our positive attributes as much as our like deepest like wells of insecurity, and Marnie's definitely that for me. I have seen myself more in Hannah as well as time has gone on, which has been a journey, because I hadn't rewatched this show before doing this podcast, and revisiting Hannah and reconnecting with her has been like kind of a little joy, like one of the great things about the show, I think. Like, you do kind of, you really come to understand all of them by the end, but like Hannah most of all, especially in this episode.
Totally.
Yeah. Totally. I guess that's in that, just to go back briefly to what I was saying before, like how it's, you know, it can feel cringy to say like, I am the main character. In this show, it's not actually that cringy because no one is a great person. It's not like you're saying you think you're perfect when you say you're any one of these mm-hmm. people. Actually, it's like the opposite.
Exactly. You're just deciding which flaw you'd like to share.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, which is most prominent. Exactly. I don't know. This is semi, I guess, related. Brenda, are you at all like interested in astrology, or like, do you buy it? Are you anti any? Where do you land on the spectrum?
I love it. I'm not, I really only know about the signs that are in my own chart, which is maybe a Hannah move. I know a lot about those signs, and I love to ask people about it because it like is very revealing about what they see in themselves, or what they, I honestly love to ask people, I'm like, do I seem like a Virgo to you? And I like to see why I seem like one or don't.
So. Yeah, I feel like I don't totally buy it, but it is an interesting way to talk about personality and like how you see yourself, how other people see you. I'm asking because we've never talked about the girls' zodiac signs or like which sign they might be.
Ooh, yeah. And
Marnie's a textbook Virgo.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Question mark. Mm-hmm. Shosh. Maybe an Aries?
Yeah, I can see Aries for her. Jessa's probably a Gemini or a Scorpio. Like, maybe more of a Scorpio than a Gemini.
Or a Leo, maybe?
Ooh, I could see a Leo, too.
Oh, yeah. Or Maybe Shoja's Leo then. I don't know. I don't know enough about the nuances. But Hannah maybe is Pisces, very emotional. I don't know.
Yeah, she's got Pisces. Yeah. She's got Pisces in the chart. Oh, Marnie probably has Libra in her chart, like very aesthetically focused. Oh, another tweet. Did you guys see that tweet that was like, that was someone saying you could buy the dress from the episode where she sings Stronger?
Oh my God. The actual dress?
It's like it's like from like Forever 21 or something. You can buy it for like $20. I know. I was like, that.
Oh my God, Halloween is just around the corner.
Exactly. It was like,
perfect. True. True. If you did that, you would be a hero.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. I'll get my measurements. I will get, I'll get on forever21.com right after this, or like, if I can depop something and have it get to me in a day and a half, like, I will do my best here, because that, it is such an iconic costume, like instantly recognizable. Mm-hmm. I don't have the wig though, but I could just go in my natural brown hair and have that be like,
I think that would be really funny.
And a mic, all you need is a mic.
I don't think you need a wig. Yeah, just get the mic, get the dress, you'll be good.
I'm like envisioning this in my mind and it's just like perfect.
And at whatever party or bar or whatever you do, you'll have to of course do a presentation.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I am doing karaoke this weekend as part of one of my Halloween things. So like,
Oh my God.
I mean, if you don't do this, I'll be sad.
Okay. I mean, like, I don't know what the ethics of doing a Kanye song at karaoke are these days, especially in these trying times. But
if you're wearing a Marnie dress, there it's, you know, any even, it's not about Kanye.
It's not about Kanye.
It's not at all about him.
And if they push comes to shove, I can always do that. Like, what I'm now realizing is an Edie Brickell song, not a Marnie Michaels original. Though, like, I'm not aware of so many things. Like, I could do that.
Yeah, that could be fun too. Yeah,
was a Marnie
original. Got some options. And then you can end with what did she cover in the last episode? Karma Police, right?
Oh, Karma Police.
Yeah. She, and the episode we watched last week, which we will recap in a moment, they're driving in the car with, it's Desi, Hannah, and Marnie, and a Marnie sung cover of Karma Police is playing on the stereo. Great little Easter egg.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That is a good Easter
so
egg.
So funny.
Should we get into this episode, but recap last week's first?
Let's do it.
Okay, so last episode, Hannah, Marnie, and Desi went to Poughkeepsie for a lover's weekend that ended in disaster as Desi's oxy addiction hit a terrifying new low. Shosh, Jessa, and Elijah attended Women Entrepreneurs Meet Up Now, which ended in tears as Shosh renounced Jessa's negative influence on her life. Okay, so now this week's episode, which is, I think, unlike... This show has done a lot of two-handers and bottle episodes, but nothing like this to me.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about the episode, which we will fully discuss at the end. Okay. But we open on Hannah walking into this huge brownstone, which we find out is owned by renowned author Chuck Palmer, who I think is like a stand-in for Philip Roth. He's this kind of raunchy-ish acclaimed intellectual, correct? And Hannah recently published a sexual misconduct expose about him on a feminist blog, quote unquote.
Yeah, apparently this was like a pretty niche article on a pretty niche site that got some traction, but we're led to believe not a ton of traction. So it's odd that this man has invited Hannah to come into the apartment to confront her about the post, and it's really just causing him anguish. Weird tactic. Also important to note that Chuck is played by Matthew Reese from The Americans and other truly incredible shows. He's like a fantastic actor, married to Carrie Russell.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
To me, I never watched The Americans. but he looks familiar. I mean, he's perfect in this role. He also looks like he would be a Safdie brother.
He's definitely in Safdie Brothers drag.
I hope that's not like anti-Semitic for me to say.
No, I think Matthew Rhys is fully Welsh, and he doesn't usually look like this. I think he got into like the whole like shaggy hair Brooklyn like hipster dad
for the role.
Look for the role, and that's acting.
Sure. I love the staging of this apartment. It's like filled with printouts of his articles and book covers and paintings of the home itself. You wrote that down, Drew. I didn't clock the paintings of the home itself.
Yeah, and he has that mug that says like I heart Chuck or whatever that he drinks out of. It's like, yeah. God.
There's a picture of him with Toni Morrison.
Oh yeah. Oh. And Hannah's like, I noticed your picture. And he's like, oh, good. I'm glad you noticed. And she's like, well, you put it right in front of me. Like, yeah. Of course I'm gonna see so it.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah. I briefly read like a little interview with the director about it. And he was talking about like, you know, with these bottle episodes, like, especially this one, it's just dialogue. Like, how do you make it interesting? And I think one of the things he was just talking about keeping that in mind and like kind of the setting being a big part of that and like having so much detail, so many of these little details. It really does keep you like looking around even when they're just kind of in the same house the whole time.
Yeah, like it definitely could have run the risk of, I mean, same with like the Patrick Wilson episode where it's just, that's his name, right?
Yeah.
So like when Hannah does the little like sexual vacation in his apartment. Just having it set in one apartment and with one conversation between these two characters, I don't know if it doesn't always land for me on Girls. This episode, I guess there was more to it, but I don't know how captivated I was by this conversation, if I'm being honest. Like, I guess we ought to say what the conversation is. He was accused by quote-unquote Denise on Tumblr that he used his college book tour as like a way to hook up with girls, her being one of the girls, and forced her into oral sex.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this whole kind of debate about power and whether this was an abuse of power and blah blah blah, and I don't know, it felt very of its time, you know.
Yeah, so I don't know if we want to sprinkle these in throughout the episode, but because this episode is so differently structured than what the episodes we usually talked about, I aggregated a few little prompts that we could maybe discuss at various points, and I think the first one I wrote down dovetails pretty neatly with what you just said.
Please.
So, first prompt. I feel like we're in like very Schoolhouse Rock today. This episode was written and filmed a year before the hashtag MeToo movement came to prominence. So how prescient is American Bitch, and how did the movement shape our like retrospective understanding of this episode?
Wow, that is very interesting. I didn't realize that it preceded that. Cause as I was watching it, I kind of felt like, you know, most of this is discourse that I am like very familiar with, but I guess what year did this come out then? 2017?
So this came out in February 2017, but it was written and filmed in June 2016. So pre-election and stuff too.
And so the question was like, how kind of ahead of its time was this, considering that Me Too was like a whole year later?
Yeah, I think ahead of its time, and also how easy is it to appreciate this episode given that the discourse has like waxed and waned and evolved in such interesting ways since this?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, what struck me as odd was, I don't know. I mean, yeah, so there's the one element where the kind of feminist discourse felt a little like, like misuse of power, kind of like, you know, that is not surprising. Like, but I'm sure at the time it was a less kind of, I think especially like the conversations about how ordinary it was, you know, how often this happens, and like the more subtle points of, you know, like he watching him get so mad about gray area, like I feel like all of that was probably pretty, and then kind of realizing that the gray area like conversation is generally misused by men to get away with things rather than like an actually like, you know, intellectually rigorous conversation to have. It's more, you know, whatever. I felt like all of that was pretty was probably felt pretty new at the time. What felt odd to me from a storytelling perspective was like how quickly Hannah transitioned from being against him to being kind of like enamored or like kind of softened up or whatever. Cause I was just like, would this happen this quickly? Like, would this happen over the course of an afternoon? And I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, it was clearly the conversation was starting before Me Too, I guess, actually officially begun. So there, it was definitely in the air. And I feel like maybe Hannah's, how quickly she softened, maybe, I guess you could think about it as proof of her convictions. I mean, like, or lack thereof, you know, like she's, maybe she doesn't totally buy what she's selling, or she's willing to, I guess, hear what he has to say. I don't know, or just Lena Dunham as a writer is willing to see both sides.
Yeah. It could also be an illustration of that, like, no one is immune from the power imbalance either. Like, even though Hannah starts the afternoon in a position of leverage because of the expose that she's published, she ends it in a pretty similar situation to, like, the girls that he's accused of harassing and coercing.
I guess you're right. Like, on the total opposite end, it could just be further proving her point. Like, you know, men kind of, I mean, he uses his charm and his banter and argumentative skills to make you on his side.
And his the manipulation is so crazy all the throughout the episode. Like, he keeps reinforcing that she's very funny, that she's a great writer, that she needs to be using her humor and her talent to write about things that actually matter. And he like asserts at the beginning that like what he has done does not actually matter in the grand scheme of things. So why is she even writing about it?
Right. He's able to self-victimize really successfully by being like, I can't sleep. I can't sleep. And it's like, first of all, you were just in the New York Times and you didn't even have to read this article. It's like the way, you know, Lena position or Hannah positions it, where she's like, this is some random blog. Like, you don't have to be reading about these things, you know. It's like, but yeah. And so I do see how, you know, Hannah's character is clearly a kind of example of the stories that she was telling in her article. You know, it plays out in her own life. And yeah, I mean, watching it, I did think like it did make a good point of how you can really politically have language for something and then emotionally act a different way. And I've like, you know, seen that happen in my own life, in my own interactions with men, where I'm like, I can very clearly articulate what this man is doing wrong, but like, I still want to feel like loved, you know? And sometimes that sentiment really overpowers your feelings of like knowing how you should be treated or how you should interact with men or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
So one of the really interesting scenes I liked from this episode was Hannah, they're like debating, I guess, like what a non-consensual blowjob could constitute, like something about like handlebars and pigtails, which I never heard before. Like,
so funny. I mean, yeah, he's basically trying to make the point. He's like, what does that even mean? How could you even do a non-consensual blowjob? And Hannah answers it very literally. She's like, It would involve a lot of head holding and right. Yeah, it's so funny. It also just shows like his rhetoric, you know, like rhetoric is his, that's what he's working with. He's trying to persuade her that, you know, this is no big deal. I didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it shows his, sorry.
Oh, no, go on.
Oh, I was gonna say it shows his kind of willful ignorance. Like we see, I mean, that's just like, that's a dumb question, you know, that like that question that he asks ignores all of the power dynamics, all of the ways that coercion happens emotionally rather than physically. And we see from the little like piece he wrote about Denise, is that her name? About the girl, like he's very, when he wants to be, he's capable of writing things with like a fine tooth. What's the word? Fine. Like he's very observant. Mm-hmm. He's very emotionally attuned when it serves him. And then there's other times where he's like, how could you give a blowjob? Like, how could you give a non-consensual blowjob? So it's like very clear that he can be emotionally tuned when it serves him and not when it doesn't.
And he's very good at making people feel small too. Like, right? He interrupts this conversation to take a phone call from his ex-wife that feels very like conveniently timed, and just leaves Hannah to wander around the apartment for a while. And when she comes back and he finishes up the phone call, he calls his wife a very tortured woman, with a lot of problems. And it's just, yeah, another example of like being very like glib about a woman's like agency and just like mental acuity to actually be able to make her own decisions and like act rationally.
Yeah, like he clearly doesn't really understand women or have any interest in understanding women. And I don't know, I thought it was interesting also how there's this Philip Roth comparison at the end, which we'll get to. He gives Hannah a signed copy of a like quote unquote misogynistic but good Philip Roth book, according to Hannah. And I think it maybe just shows like this how this kind of, I guess, misogynistic fiction writer is, despite writing about women in this way, adored and also, you know, considered a genius, and even Hannah's falling for it, which, you know, I'm not, no judgment call either way, you know, and I actually like Philip Roth, so I don't know. It's complicated.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that for this man, like, women don't exist outside of his perception of them. Like his wife exists in the realm of like the phone call he has with her and the way that he, you know, and even his daughter, like, I mean, there's so much about his daughter that we can get into, but I feel like he really uses his daughter to make himself seem good. And I felt like he kind of, you know, he uses his daughter as a shield against criticism, where he's like, what if, you know, what if my daughter's friends see these, this piece you wrote and it ruins her life? And it's like, you don't care about your daughter. You care about yourself and you're using her. And then he like uses his daughter as a foil to his wife, where he's like, my wife is troubled, but she created this beautiful daughter. And it's like, again, you're using your daughter to like, you know, just shit talk your wife. And then like, you know, and then he positions himself in this way that men sometimes do, like they use their proximity to women as a way to like signal that they're a good man, you know, where he's like, I love my daughter. I couldn't possibly be the kind of guy who preys on young women.
Right. As a father to daughters.
Yeah.
Very exactly. Father to daughters. Yeah. A lot of what he says is like foregrounded in a fear of getting caught by his daughter's friends too. Like he constantly references that, like, I don't want my daughter's friends like seeing this online and like telling her. And I'm like, so you're like stripping away your daughter's like your daughter's not a baby either, but like that kind of makes you seem like more of a protector to her in that way. And it's just,
I mean, also just how at the end of the episode, spoiler alert, when he whips his dick out and then you hear like, dad, you know, the daughter walks in and he's totally just unfazed. He's like, I don't know, like, yeah. you don't really care, clearly.
So I think this is a good segue into Oh God, the internet of it all. In the kitchen, they have a big discussion about the internet's role in emboldening victims and accusers. That felt very of its time then. And it's a conversation that I think has been like played to death in the ensuing 6 years, but like it's something that obviously still keeps happening. This is when I thought the writing of the episode faltered a little bit, with the mention of the Salem witch trials and like Matthew Rhys saying like I'm the witch or whatever. Like it felt a little obvious for this show, maybe.
Yeah, I completely agree. I feel like it was very much after school special, like we're teaching you a lesson right now. You know, the dialogue felt a bit stilted. And yeah, I don't know. I also something I thought about, when did cancel culture, I know it's been a term longer than it was has been a popular term, but when did it start as a popular term?
Oh God, like probably, that I mean, it must have been 10 years ago, right?
I don't know, but it, like they don't use the word canceled once is something I picked up on. So it probably was before that was a word we used every single day. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting, but Chuck says someone can like destroy your life with a single post. And then Hannah argues like that cancel culture without using this term doesn't exist. You know, you have this amazing apartment, you have these great reviews in the Times, which I feel like is an argument that I guess we're still having to this day and that just continues to be proven right. Like cancel culture isn't, I mean, it was really real for a while, for a bit, you know, with Me Too. And I just over the years, people got tired and it's totally just not, people forget or people just want to forget or, you know, don't care.
Yeah. I think like something that stuck with me was one time just like reading, I don't know, it's a tweet or someone saying like, even like in the most high profile cases, well, it was two things. One was that like an editor somewhere saying this like really heartbreaking thing she realized during Me Too was that like, you know, a lot, there were a few high profile cases or like things that kind of got a lot of attention, and she said like as an editor lots of people started sending her their personal narratives of like this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened, and she had to just respond to all these women who were like sharing their most traumatic events being like, yeah, this isn't gonna get like published, like the only stories that are getting published are stories that are like deemed quote-unquote newsworthy, but of course like how can you say one person's story is worth sharing and another person's isn't? And so in that way, like, you know, well, that's just kind of one of the shortcomings I felt like of like the Me Too moment was like, we all kind of like, I think we're really prompted to share our trauma, but like there wasn't, it didn't really mean there was going to be justice in most cases. And then another thing, just going back, tying back to what you were saying specifically about cancel culture not being real was like, I remember seeing a tweet that was like, you know, even in these most high profile cases, which are the only ones that really are getting told, like, most of the time, do you even remember the names of the survivors? Like, no, you really don't. And yet there's so much panic from men and just from people in general of like this ruining a man's life. But like 90% of the time, you don't remember the names of the women who came forward, but like their careers and their lives are like changed forever.
Yeah. So I think this is a good transition into one of the other little prompts that I had. How much is Chuck Palmer meant to be a Lena Dunham stand-in?
Oh, that's a good question. Wow, we should do these prompts more often. I love that.
I think the reason I was thinking about this during the episode, because obviously the sexual misconduct of it all is not something that, well, Lena has faced one spurious allegation about that from her memoir, but a lot of the criticism here seems to me about like the lasting impact of cancel culture, as we have talked about on the podcast, not in great detail, but like one of these days we will get around to it. Lena Dunham is one of the most like frequently quote unquote canceled people of the modern internet age. Like it for people who were not really online in like from 2013 to 2017, Lena Dunham truly was getting like called out for something once a week, like clockwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She very was... little ramifications.
Yes. Right. I mean, other than just everyone hating her.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was definitely the, as they say, the main character of the internet every single week.
And right. Like some of it was very innocuous. Like her standing Tinashe and tweeting like MJ Doctor, they killing me. One of my favorite Lena Dunham tweets of all time. But a lot of it was like, I think everyone just needs to go Google Lena Dunham, Odell Beckham Jr. Look at kind of the worst case scenario for how like clueless, borderline racist and tone deaf she could be when she was really like not firing on any of her cylinders. No professional ramifications though. And like, to me, Chuck is sort of an interrogation of that aspect of her persona in some way, because this is clearly a man who's regarded as a very skilled thought leader of his generation, mm-hmm. who's not really facing any ramifications for his more unsavory acts. But I'm curious to hear what y'all think about this, because I might be reading into this a little too much.
No, that is something that came to mind for me too, was like, and obviously, you know, whatever, different identities are not a one-to-one comparison, but I do think the way that he is positioned as just totally tone deaf, not only tone deaf, but like doubling down on his position and unwilling to kind of engage in a worldview that is not his own, to, you know, much to his, in a way that serves him, was is similar to the way that Lena Dunham kind of famously engaged with race in those years. And she did face a lot of criticism for it, and I don't really see her changing much in her storytelling. But again, it's like, I don't know, there's this really great Ta-Nehisi Coates essay about Girls, where because you know, remember after the first season everyone was like, why are there no people of color on this show? And then she like, she kind of tried, but like she just never, I don't think there's any meaningful like people of color really on Girls. You know, there's Donald Glover's character on season two, who she like makes a Republican weirdly, which is, again, it's just like mm-hmm. weird and not really humanizing, I don't think. But anyway, in the Ta-Nehisi Coates essay, he says like he doesn't really expect her to like be able to tell the stories of anyone but herself, because she's so like, you know, diaristic in her storytelling, and also she just doesn't have any friends who aren't white. But anyway, in that essay, he quotes some things that she and the show creator, what's the show creator's name, Jenny something, that they said at the time, and it was like pretty vile. I can't like remember it off the top of my head, but it was like definitely very racist. So that is, yeah, those are my thoughts. She couldn't engage with race at all.
Yeah. And it doesn't seem like that's ever going to be a strength of hers.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. I see. And that's also why I wonder, like, I don't know if it was that self-aware, you know, I think she might have just been responding to the moment. I really like that read on it, but yeah, I feel like for a long time, Lena Dunham really saw herself as like, maybe not a victim, but like sort of unfairly criticized.
I mean, she definitely, if you read articles about her from like the camping era, her often forgotten second HBO show, a lot of it is about like
her and Jenny
Connor. I mean, she was in peak victim then, because it was right after the Jack Antonoff breakup, right after the dissolution of her partnership with Jenny Connor, the other kind of creative force behind Girls. Yeah, and then that show was hot garbage. So
I wanted to like that show so bad.
Ooh, I really only have seen the pilot.
I really tried with it because I was so kind of desperate for it to be good, and it was bad. I think Brett Goodman was in it, and I like him.
I guess anyway. I have a question. Sorry.
No, go.
I was going to say, I guess I have a question. If you do think that what's his name, Chuck, that's the guy's name, mm-hmm. Chuck, is a stand-in for Lena, do you think that, even if subconsciously, do you think that then Lena in some way, like, sympathizes with him? Is there some, like, yeah, is there some element of that?
I feel like there's, I mean, regardless of whether he's a stand-in, I feel like there's definitely some sympathy for him, you know, that I can, even at the end when the daughter's playing her little flute number and it kind of zooms in on his face excitedly watching her, he's, you know, it's kind of telling us, like, he's just a guy, like, he's mm-hmm. just a pervert, but he's also a father, and he's, you know, can't help that he's a pervert. Like, that's my, not as black and white, but it definitely, she's definitely sympathetic to him.
Yeah. And I mean, she also clearly feels comfortable enough with him, or defensive, or some mixture of the both, to reveal her own, like, story with grooming, mm-hmm. That she experienced when she was in fifth grade from an English teacher, which mm-hmm. is lifted directly, apparently, from Lena's memoir.
Yeah.
Basically, wholesale.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like, yeah, I feel mixed on what my own answer is to that, because I feel like just the fact that it shifted from, like, her being on the defensive to her being, like, kind of wooed by him, and we already talked about this, but that happened so quickly that part of me is like, okay, there is some, like, empathizing with his character, or, like, we're supposed to watch this with the ability to ourselves kind of, like, empathize with him very quickly. But then at the end, that look that you get from him, like, that horror look, like, that to me is not very humanizing or empathetic. Like, I personally felt, like, very scared watching that, like, smile on his face in that moment. So I feel, yeah, I've kind of have mixed feelings there about that.
Yeah.
Actually, that does remind me of one other thing I wanted to bring up about that moment. Like, I was thinking about that and the preceding episode, and I was thinking about, like, the use of horror in these moments where, like, I don't know. I mean, it's not horror. The episode is not, like, a horror episode, but in that moment, like, I genuinely felt scared. And it felt like, you know, it felt like a horror movie. And then it reminded me of the previous episode where they kind of, I mean, it was mostly kind of campy, but, like, the way Desi's, like, breaking in and, like, there's these jump scares.
Oh my God.
And yeah. I thought that was interesting, like, this very kind of random specific use of horror in the depiction of, like, what it's like to relate with women, relate with men as a woman. I thought that was interesting. And it reminded me specifically of Pen 15, the last season, how there are these just random moments of, like, horror or, like, film noir. And, you know, that season is all about these two women coming of age and, like, learning also to kind of engage with men, and it, they use horror to, like, to show what that's like.
Mm-hmm.
That's
was
point.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were talking last episode. Sorry, I'll let you cut in, Drew. But yeah, we were just talking last episode about that. It is so horror when yeah. like it's funny, but it's mm-hmm. jump scares when mm-hmm. Desi's, you know, breaking glass and trying to get into the house. But Drew, go ahead.
And just, like, the final kind of reveal, that, like, wolfish smile that he smiles after he, like, essentially successfully gets her to, like, fall into his trap and, like, grab his dick. Like, there is something horror about that. Like,
yeah.
Have y'all read that Joyce Carol Oates story, Where Have You, what's it? Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been?
Mm-mm.
Okay, it's really good. I would recommend it to everyone, and I don't really want to spoil the ending, but I would say it similarly has a parallel theme of, like, a woman kind of, like, knowing that she is falling for a trap and submitting to it anyway. Mm-hmm. The Joyce story is much more horror base than I think the ending of this is, but like I couldn't like stop thinking about it when I was watching this.
I feel like it was horror, yeah, for this, the fact that like you watch it and from you're kind of like, oh my god, no, don't do that, don't sit so, like I watched it with my roommate, she was like, oh my god, she's sitting so close to him on the couch. And again, it's not to like blame Hannah for any of this happening, like it's more just like you can see yourself in that, in those moments. Yeah. And you can be like, oh my god, yeah, this is you, the yeah, you see how it's gonna happen. And he set a trap, and like even down to the fact that like he must have, I read this actually in the New Yorker piece about it, but like he knew when his daughter was coming home, you know, like he timed it perfectly so that like he would be saved by the bell, you know?
Yeah. I think this is a good transition into one of the last prompts I had written down for today. So Brenda made a reference to this incredible New Yorker piece from 2017 written by Emily Nussbaum that talks about this episode, in which that she writes that the canniest trick Chuck plays in this episode is making Hannah feel like just another woman. How do we think, how does that quote resonate?
Yeah, I thought that was genius. I love that that take, because you know, it's like his, there's like I felt like one of the kind of, we've talked about this already, but one of the like Chekhov's guns of this episode was the line, you're funny. Like he says it three times throughout the episode. First he like says it in his way where he's like informing her, and you know, he's like, and I think that Emily Nussbaum says this in the piece, he's like setting her apart, he's telling her like, you're not like other girls, like you're funny, you individually are funny. And then he says it again the final time right before he like asks her to lie down in the bed with him, and he's like telling her he is allowing her to be funny in his eyes, but then he's like taking away her agency. So it's like this really scary thing of like, he's been building her up and making her feel so special only so that he can use that feeling for his own, you know, his own whatever gain.
Yeah, definitely. Just making her feel like just another girl. Yeah, he makes her feel, I mean, I guess I don't have much to add. He pretends like she's some, I don't know. And it just calls into question everything he said leading up to that point, which as a viewer, I fell for, you know, like he said, I invited you over because I like your writing, you're funny, you're interesting, you know, things that, yeah, I as a viewer believe to be true. And even after the, you know, Dick incident, I was like, wait, was he lying about that? I mean, call me naive, but I don't know.
Yeah. And then there's like that last scene where there's two things. So there's the last scene where although she leaves and she, you know, she got away, but then all the women are going into his apartment. So it's like, they're all literally, you know, all the same, like in this, you know, visual representation. And the other thing that struck me as interesting was it starts with this like instrumental, whatever song at the beginning. And it just, in the moment, I like wrote it down because I was like, oh, like I feel like Hannah is at her best when she's like, you know, dancing to pop music. I remember I think a Gia piece in the New Yorker also said like Hannah's at her best when she's dancing to Robin, and that stuck out to me because I was like, oh, this starts with an instrumental song, that's so weird, and then it ends with the flute bit that's instrumental again, and as Hannah leaves it turns into Rihanna singing like a pop song. And I think we see Hannah leave the home, and like I think the instrumental music is like his space, like the space of like propriety and control. And then we hear the pop music and it's like, okay, she's on her own turf again, but like as long as she's in this world of this kind of like instrumental music, like she doesn't have agency, she's not in her world, she's not like, she's not the main character, you know.
And that's, he deprives a really interesting point. That's a really, really interesting point.
I like that a lot.
I think there's a way to read the ending shot as obviously very pessimistic in a way, because it's symbolism in a way this show doesn't usually dabble in. A sea of faceless women just streaming into this brownstone. But I think the music theory of it all lends it a little bit of optimism too, because she's secure in herself. She fell for this trap, but like, she's not going to stop talking. Like, Hannah just at her core can't stop talking. So like, she's always going to speak up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know what I will say. I'm not necessarily sure this Hannah feels entirely of a piece with like the Hannah we sometimes see in the rest of the show. Like, this was a shockingly self-possessed and articulate Hannah Horvath in a way, like outside of the like the pigtail handlebars that felt very vintage Hannah Horvath, but she's definitely a little bit more like fervent and well-spoken than she usually is. I don't know if that's an uncharitable read, though.
No, I feel like even in last week's episode, we talked about how in this final season, with each episode, she's kind of becoming more coherent and well-spoken. And yeah. Just, you know, she's kind of, yeah, I guess learning how to talk about situations and get herself out of situations.
Yeah. I mean, she's also like in this episode, I mean, usually she's just like talking about herself, right? Like, she like has some observation. I think in another episode, she's like, I'm telling you the secret, but that this doesn't make me a bad secret teller. Like, those are the kinds of things she's saying. But in this episode, she's like moving beyond herself in a kind of rare way. And it makes her, and she's very like, you know, coherent in how she talks about it, but it's also, it makes her come across as different from her usual self.
Yeah. Do we have any final thoughts about this episode? General positive sentiments, negative sentiments?
Let's see. Did I have anything else? Oh, I want to read two lines I really liked. Okay. One was, let's see. He goes, Chuck is like, are you even an activist? And she says, nope, I don't even recycle, which I thought was funny. Very Hannah, very just millennial. And also just love that she's admitting to that. Mm-hmm. I feel like another kind of mark of a older, wiser Hannah. And then I love this line right here, which I felt deeply. She says she wants someone to write about her being a total cunt, something along those lines. And he's like, really? And she's like, yeah, what would be better than to like ruin someone's life with your wanton sex appeal and like icicle sharp intellect? But I'm half Jewish, so I don't really see that happening for me. So good. Scream. Mm-hmm. And I think, I think that's pretty much all I had to say about the episode. But actually talking about it now, I like it more than I remember liking it.
It's definitely not perfect. And look, obviously a lot of the discourse that this episode references is both played out and a lot more evolved now than what it was at the time. I think this, the real like ideological strength of this episode is its like pessimistic attitude towards cancel culture, which I think it's, I don't think this is a prescriptive ideology. Like, she's not offering like fixes for like rehabilitation or like, you know, how people should talk about it. But like, I think it is very realistic about how the internet as a court of law, let's say, is not punitive. Like, mm-hmm. people can talk, but that's the worst punishment and the only consequences that most people are going to face. And I think that's a very bold take for 2017. I think it's not as much so in 2023, but like,
yeah,
it's very interesting. And especially coming from the woman, this is an episode solely written by Lena. And I think it's just, there's a lot of interesting perspective around it that I really do find fascinating.
I think the part that I found most I liked the most was just how humanizing it was for like women who go through this. I and you know, and especially just, she has the language to understand exactly what is happening and the way men misuse power. And then you see how it still happens. And like, I found that personally very relatable. And again, humanizing and like, I guess whatever the opposite of victim blaming is, mm-hmm. you know, just, yeah, humanizing. And I think that's the great strength of the episode is you leave being like, yeah, this literally could happen to anyone. And it's not a moral failing. It's not a personal failing. It's just like, it is how men use power and emotions and, you know. Mm-hmm.
I did have one final thought actually about the episode. And that is that Desperado by Rihanna is a 10 out of 10 pop song.
It is.
It's so good.
That whole album is a no skips album.
No skips.
No skips.
If that's the last Rihanna album we ever get, which is looking very likely, what a one to go out on. It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm happy with it.
I have to be honest, I didn't fill out any of the final segments this week because I'm like,
we can talk through them. They're honestly, some of them have no answer, some of them do, but yeah. I usually ask, which girl are you in this episode? Girl is non-gendered, but mm-hmm. we only have a few characters we're working with, three to be exact.
Right.
So I guess I wrote, I suppose I'm Hannah, but you know, I could also be the flute daughter. It just depends which life I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Do you have any like strong opinions about that, Brenda? It's tough. I mean, unless you, no one's going to say they're Chuck, you know?
Yeah.
Right. No, yeah, definitely Hannah here, I think.
Yeah, I can kind of get on the Hannah wavelength. Much like the daughter, I did play instruments growing up. So in that way, I am also the flute daughter.
I love the flute daughter.
Yeah, she was cute. It sucks that she has such a shithead dad.
I know. She's going to have something to talk about.
Okay, I do have a fit check actually for this week. And those were Chuck's house slippers that he like very obviously stole from a hotel.
That's a pretty cool move, honestly.
I've done it. I think everyone should do it at least once because those are replaceable and they are, I do think, more comfortable than any house slippers you will find on the open market.
Totally. I didn't have a fit check. But Hannah is wearing, I mean, she's always, she loves to wear an unflattering, kind of confusing outfit. And she's wearing one of those this week, which I appreciate.
Yeah, same. Yeah. Nothing particularly stood out.
And then our last segment is MVP and LVP. I mean, I don't. This really does feel like an episode where everyone loses. Like, Chuck is obviously the biggest monster of the episode, so I guess he gets LVP, but, like, I can't give an MVP here. The set designer. No. I thought this was a beautiful house. That's my MVP.
That is it. That's the answer. It was a beautiful house. I was like, fuck, could you imagine? Wow, that was, I wonder if we can come up with an, oh, I have a good one. Something we said we were going to do, which is Sound of the Week. But there's just one song, right? Is Desperado the only song?
There's just one song.
Okay, yeah. Well, guess we're fucked. No, I thought this was a great episode. Do we have any other, like, segments we could do that mean anything?
Okay, it doesn't mean anything necessarily, but, like, I do want to, this was not a funny episode outside of a few lines here and there. This was a very interesting one to talk about, but this is probably the heaviest episode of the podcast I think we've done since the episode with the Q-tip and Adam and Natalia. So,
probably true.
This is what I would like to know. I would like everyone to go around and name one very underrated Rihanna song that you would like people to revisit over Halloween weekend, because this episode is coming out on Friday before Halloween. Or if you have a spooktacular song to recommend for people.
My favorite Rihanna song is Higher, also off Anti. Gorgeous song. Yeah, that's it. It's like one of my favorite, probably if I had to list like 20 songs, my favorite 20 songs of all time, it's in there.
It's a great one.
I mean, Sex With Me, I don't know. I don't think that's unsung or underrated, but I love that song.
I think it is kind of unsung, actually.
Okay, well, good, because I'm singing it.
Oh, gosh. My, like, okay, I have two, I think. Like, my anti-underrated one is Consideration. Mm-hmm. So, perfect song. Perfect, perfect song. And I think there's a St. Vincent cover out there that is also very good that I would recommend people check out. On a more, like, EDM Rihanna is still kind of my favorite era of Rihanna, though. Like, her hits from, like, 2009 to 2012, unbeatable. Like, truly unbeatable to me. And Who's That Chick is
wow,
a titanic achievement of human history, and one that I wish she had done at the Super Bowl this year.
That's a call out if I ever heard one.
It's so good. This is a dog whistle to my gays, because, like... Gaze of Taste, we know that Who's That Chick is incredible.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Well, Verinda, thank you so much for being here today. This was a very, I think, a great episode of this podcast. And we're sorry we made you watch such a bummer of an episode.
No. Thank you so much.
I'm not sorry, because you were so good on it. Like, I'm so glad we had you on. Like, this was... I thought this was a great episode to guest match, which we can't always control. But
thank you. Wow. Thank you. Well,
this is great.
This is really fun.
If you would like to be found on social media, where can people find you?
Yes. You can find me on Instagram at confident_leader, which is my alter ego. And you can find me on Twitter, which is my first and last name, Verinda Jagoda.
That's incredible. Definitely the best Insta handle that we've had from a guest, for sure. That's so good. Though I do shout out to former guest Spencer Fox. Great mouthfeel. Also a very good Insta handle. And also Charlie Bliss has a new song out today. So go check that out.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you again, Verinda. This was truly a delight. I can't wait to... I rarely listen to our episodes, but So when they're really good, I'm like, I want to hear that back. And I will probably listen.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Well, we'll see everyone next week for what, in my memory, is a very good episode featuring... I think this is one featuring a certain character from the past of the show that I'm very excited to dive into. So until next week, bye, everyone.
Bye.